Case number 13-5064, American Civil Liberties Union et al. Appellants versus United States Department of Justice. Mr. Spitzer for the appellants, Mr. Hoppel for the appellee.
May it please the court.
Good morning.
I'm Arthur Spitzer for the appellant in this case. To a criminal defendant, Your Honors, there's a world of difference between being convicted and being acquitted. But that difference is not material under Exemption 7C of the Freedom of Information Act in this case. And that's the only difference between this court's earlier decision in the same case and the current appeal. There are two sets of scales on which that difference can be measured, the privacy scale and the public interest scale, which are the two considerations that are balanced in a 7C case. On the privacy scale, this court identified 8 relevant factors in its earlier decision. 7 of the 8 are exactly the same in this case as they were in the previous case, and I can very quickly tick them off. Number 1, disclosure would reveal only a single prosecution rather than an individual's entire criminal history, as in Reporters Committee. Number 2, it would disclose only information that's already been the subject to a public proceeding. Number 3, it would disclose only information that's easily available in public records. Number 4, the information is relatively recent, not something buried in the archaeological past. Number 5, the information is not practically obscure, to use the Reporters Committee phrase. Quoting from this court's earlier opinion, if someone wants to know whether his neighbor or potential employee has been indicted for, convicted of, or pled guilty to a federal offense, he may well find out simply by entering a Google search for the person's name, close quote, or perhaps even more to the point, simply by going to the nationwide PACER case locator website and typing in the person's name. As this court pointed out, the only thing that's practically obscure is information regarding the government's policy about warrantless cell phone tracking and what the underlying records would show about that policy. What's not obscure is any information that raises issues of personal privacy. The court said that.
The panel did say that the interests, privacy interests, in the case of someone who was acquitted or for whom the charges were dropped is greater. You agree with that?
We
don't think it's much greater.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. We agreed in the earlier appeal that it was somewhat greater,
right.
Marginally greater, and I think that difference is too small to be dispositive here. In fact, I think that the difference is hard even to articulate. If I had been indicted for a federal crime and 5 years later that was going to be republicized, I would much rather have it republicized that I was indicted and acquitted than that I was indicted and found guilty, frankly.
Do you know that everyone would agree with you?
Yeah, that's your view, right?
I don't know that everyone would agree with me.
The government says, points out in its brief, that there are probably circumstances under which people who were acquitted or against whom charges were dropped would want to be left alone, that this part of their past isn't something that they would like any further public attention to.
I'm certain that's true, and I'm certain that's also true for people who are convicted and serve their time. They'd like to put it behind them.
But don't you think that the two are, even those two are different?
I think the difference is a hard to articulate. The unfairness to a person who was in fact not guilty is undoubtedly greater than the unfairness to a person who was guilty. But that's a different thing, it seems to me, than whether the information is really private or not. In neither case here is the information really private in any meaningful sense in the current world of Google and Pacer.
Suppose I think that, let me take you a little bit to both sides of your scale. Suppose I think, I know you don't agree with this, but suppose I think that the incremental test that the government argues for, that is that we, when we look at the public interest side of this, we look at the incremental benefit of just these six cases. Suppose I think that that's right. Can you still prevail in this case?
I think so, because, as you know from our brief, we don't think there is such an incremental benefit test. But assuming there is,
how would you...
These six cases, we can't know in advance which cases out of the 200-some-odd in this universe are going to be nuggets of useful information and which are going to be dross. Most of the cases we got on the first round turned out to be dross. There were a couple of nuggets. It's more likely that there'll be some nuggets in these six, certainly as a percentage, because who knows why these cases did not result in convictions. Perhaps there was a successful motion to suppress. Perhaps we actually know from the government's affidavit that there was one reversal on appeal among these six. What was the reason? Did that have anything to do with the use of the cell phone tracking, the one that was reversed on appeal? So the odds that these six cases, one or more, will tell us something useful about the government's policy and practice and the court's view of the government's policy and practice are greater than they were in the other category.
Again,
and that's the most we can say because we don't know more.
Say again what it is you might learn from this that you don't now know. Give me an example of something that you could learn from one of these six cases that you don't now know.
Well, one thing we learned, and of course this is not in the record, Your Honor, so stop me if you think I'm going too far, but we sent letters to more than 600 lawyers who we were able to identify as representing defendants in the cases that we got. We heard back from 86 of those lawyers, and to all but five of them, it was startling news that warrantless cell phone tracking, or cell phone tracking at all, had been used in their cases. They were surprised. They were often dismayed. Some of them told us that they were going to contact their clients or former clients
but you know that from the 200 and so cases that have now been revealed.
We know a little. Everybody knows that. Right. So
we know now that the government uses cell phone tracking data without warrants in hundreds of cases.
Well, Your Honor, it seems to me, I think there's more than one answer to your question, but the first one that occurs to me is, it seems to me fundamentally unfair to say that when a plaintiff makes a single FOIA request, the government provides some information and not others, and especially in a situation like this where there's a first appeal and a remand and a second appeal, to judge the case now based on where we are in 2014 rather than where we were when we made the request.
My whole set of questions was based on the fact that we do accept this incremental test. That was my basis of my question, was that we look only now at the public interest in revealing these six.
Right,
I understand your argument as to why I don't like that, and you might be right. I was just asking you to approach the question.
I would still say, as this Court pointed out in its earlier opinion, information that could be derived from suppression motions, the facts and the rulings, could be perhaps the most fruitful source of information about the policy and practice. We found only one and perhaps two in the earlier bunch of cases.
And, of course, you have to balance that against the greater privacy interest that's at stake here.
The very marginally greater.
Well, you added marginally. But the panel didn't say very marginally. The panel said greater.
The panel said greater and said that it was not deciding, because it didn't have to, whether it was sufficiently greater to make any difference in the outcome. And that indeed is the question here. But let's say among these six, we find two or three more suppression motions. That would be more than we found among the 214. And we might find significant new facts about what the government's practice had been.
How do we know what people who were acquitted, who were, whose indictments were dismissed, think?
Well, we don't know.
You say confidently that they, or you talk about how you would view it,
right.
But I'm not sure how we're supposed to make a decision in a case like this, or how we're supposed to think about it other than our own personal experiences and guesses about what people think.
Well, I mean, we have one small data point, which is that as a result of our letters to lawyers, two clients eventually called us and were very interested to learn and were interested to find out, could they now do anything about this? But that's a very small data point, I agree. But the fact that these defendants have been indicted and acquitted or the charges dismissed, that is not secret in any way. Anyone who wants to find out.
This is going into speculation, which I think this whole case is, but speculation about human nature. But some people who have something bad happens to them don't want to be reminded of it in public 3 years later, 5 years later. I think that's something that general human experience teaches us.
I agree, and that's not the slightest bit likely to happen as a result of reversal on this appeal. If I wanted to know whether my friend Mr. Koppel had ever been indicted for a federal crime, I would type his name into Pacer or Google. If he moved in next door to me, if he were hired to be my new coworker, if my daughter was going to date his son.
You might not know his name.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the two of you.
You might not do it but for the fact that as a result of this FOIA request, his name might now become public. In other words, there might not be any reason why you would type Mr. Koppel's name in. So, I mean, the question is whether reviewing this data will lead to information that, true, you might have been able to find it on your own, but many people probably wouldn't look.
Well, talking about human nature, I'm not likely to type in Mr. Koppel's name because a FOIA requester got a list of cases involving cell phone tracking. I'm much more likely to type in his name if he moves in next door to me, if his son is dating my daughter, if he's hired or applying to be a lawyer in my office. I'm going to be interested in him.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be interested in who in the country, what six people in the country, all of a sudden the ACLU has learned had an old case that was subject to cell phone tracking.
What do you think about the footnote in the Reporters Committee where the court points out that, 47 states protect the privacy of this kind of information, which means we don't really have to speculate very much, do we, about whether non-conviction information should be private? We have 47 states representing a pretty broad consensus that this information is private.
Reporters Committee was speaking more broadly than just the category involved here, which is public indictments. And we know at least one and presumably more than one of these six cases, public trials. That information is on the public record and certainly today, maybe not 25 years ago, very easy to find. We're not talking about arrests.
I wasn't suggesting that Reporters Committee controlled this. We were just, in your discussion with Judge Kavanaugh, you were focusing on whether it required speculation about how people would feel about having this information revealed. And I was just asking whether you thought that the footnote mm-hmm. or the fact that 47 states protect it might reduce the amount, the extent to which we have to speculate about that issue, in other words.
But I think that fact has changed since the days of Reporter Committee because they didn't have the Internet, they didn't have Pacer, and so the information really was practically obscure in many ways. As mm-hmm. Reporters Committee pointed out, you would have had to go, even if we were just talking about the federal system, much less 50 states and thousands of counties, you would have had to go to hundreds of U.S. district courthouses and look at paper files in every one. Today, there's a nationwide PACER case locator, and so from the comfort of your desk, you can find out not an arrest, not an investigation, but you can find out a and not a sealed indictment, which we're not seeking here, but you can find out the fact of a public indictment without the slightest bit of trouble. And so the practical obscurity that existed then and was reinforced by those state laws simply doesn't exist anymore in 2014. If I have time to speak for a moment or two about the public interest scale, there's no difference on that scale between the previous appeal of this case and this case either. The government's only distinction is this incremental benefit test, and I think I've tried to explain why the incremental benefit test is satisfied in this case, even if it were to apply, which we think it doesn't.
Okay.
If I may reserve some time, Your Honor.
Yeah, we'll give you a few extra minutes.
May it please the Court. I'm John Cappell from the Appellate Staff, Civil Division, U.S. Department of Justice, and I pronounce it Coppel, but that wouldn't affect the way it would be Googled. And with me is my colleague, Leonard Scheitman, also from the Appellate Staff, and I'm representing the appellee, U.S. Department of Justice. As this Court has recognized from its questions, the prior panel in this case held that there was a stronger privacy interest in non-disclosure of the material of prosecutions relating to individuals who were acquitted or whose cases were dismissed than with respect to those who were convicted or pled guilty. And that is a bedrock principle which flows from the presumption of innocence, and there's a strong interest in simply being let alone, as the Court has recognized from its questioning, that people may very well, particularly individuals who were acquitted, who've gone through the legal process with a successful outcome, may very well not want to be reminded of that fact and subject to the kind of embarrassment and stigmatization that can flow from renewed public disclosure. On the other side of the balance here, it is clear from this Court's case law that there is indeed a public interest, that there is an incremental value component to the public interest test. And the Court specifically used that language in Schrecker, and in doing so it cited the language from Bast, which is a 1981 case, where the Court said, thus it is the incremental advantage to the public of releasing the undisclosed portions of the 12 documents which must be weighed against the invasion of personal privacy. So
doesn't mean when the government releases some information, it then can say, therefore, you're not entitled to other because you already have enough.
No, Your Honor, that's not what we're saying. This case arises in a somewhat unusual posture by virtue of the fact that it was essentially bifurcated by the district court in the initial phase, the initial decision into case involving individuals who were convicted or pled guilty versus individuals who were acquitted or whose cases were dismissed. So it was treated as a whole initially by the government, and the government compiled the information with respect to all of those cases. But in the prior round, in this Court held that the public interest in disclosure overrode the privacy interest only with respect to the individuals who were convicted or who pled guilty. So we're here, and as a result of that, the government disclosed 214 cases in which that requirement was satisfied. So here we're only talking about the remaining six in this litigation, and that is the universe that it's appropriate to look at
Why wouldn't you talk about the public interest the same way? You seem to be falling back into what you said you're not doing, which is because you have the 214, you don't need the other six. But isn't the public interest still the same for all 220?
Well, the public interest is attenuated with respect to the remaining six by virtue of the tremendous disclosure that has already been made regarding the 214.
So and that 100, if 100 had been disclosed, would that mean there wasn't significant public interest in getting the other 114?
Your Honor, it may be that there would be a sliding scale with respect to the amount of disclosure that has been made.
I mean, I don't know how we administer something like that on the public interest side. This whole balancing is difficult for courts to administer to begin with, as you know, but to have that kind of sliding scale strikes me as particularly challenging.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that in a case like this, it shouldn't be difficult just by virtue of the numbers involved and the fact that there has been an extensive disclosure, and that's what the court was driving at in cases like Schrecker and Bass.
But I guess here to flip Judge Tatel's question to appellant's counsel, if the public interest is the same here as it was in the prior case, but the privacy interest is slightly more significant, you think you prevail even if the public interest is the same?
But I certainly couldn't concede. I wouldn't concede that the public interest is the same. It's the same type of public interest, but it's not entitled to the same weight because of the amount of disclosure that has already occurred.
You're fighting the hypothetical now. Yeah. The hypothetical is that the public interest is the same.
Well, if the public interest is the same, yes, the privacy interest, the greater privacy interest here, should override it because
why?
Because it is speculative in the extreme that same public interest would really be served by disclosure in this case, by disclosure of the remaining documents in this case.
If the public interest is, let's just say the public interest is substantial, real, meaningful, I don't know what adjectives we use, but the privacy interest here is stronger than it was in the prior case, and maybe there's a categorical rule, presumption that people who haven't been convicted, they have a substantial privacy interest in not having information connected to criminal proceedings disclosed under 7C. Is that a fair way to look at this?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that is.
I don't know how we do that balancing, though. I guess that's what the Supreme Court was struggling with in Reporters Committee, where it then said it may be appropriate to come up with categorical sub-rules or sub-principles to try to navigate this, because otherwise I don't see how we do it. I really don't like, as you can tell, the idea of saying, because 214 have been disclosed, the next six have no or much diminished public interest. And that strikes me as a hard thing to do going forward for us in future cases.
Well, I, with respect to your point on categorical withholding, yeah, that is exactly what the Supreme Court did in Reporters Committee. And it's also, it was the same. This court arrived at a categorical decision in the first ACLU opinion as well. And we believe that it would be appropriate, equally appropriate, to do that here, especially in light of the fact that, as the court recognized, the Supreme Court emphasized in Reporters Committee that the respect that should be accorded to non-conviction data in terms of the privacy, the heightened privacy interest, which this court also reiterated, alluded to in the ACLU 1 opinion.
We have a lot of cases that say that, although they're usually about suspects and witnesses, not about people who've been indicted. But so this would be a bit of an extension of those cases.
Although, well, they generally include, even though they specifically refer and arise in the context of people who were only investigated, the general principle would apply equally to those who are acquitted, and this court has basically not distinguished. And indeed, it recognized, in ACLU 1, it recognized a sliding scale with respect to the privacy interests of those first who were just investigated and not prosecuted, and then those who were acquitted or cases were dismissed, and then the third category, those who were convicted or pled guilty. So, granted, there is speculation on both sides here, but we believe that under those circumstances, the admittedly greater privacy interest here should carry the day. That's in keeping with the principle, with the presumption of innocence, with the right to be let alone, with the fact that these
How about the DOJ press conferences announcing indictments? That doesn't seem to be a real recognition of the privacy interests of people who haven't been convicted.
But that is before they have been vindicated by the legal process and their cases have concluded favorably for them, either by an acquittal or a dismissal. It's consistent. The government is fulfilling its interest in informing the public and allowing the public to monitor criminal proceedings when it announces indictments. And it doesn't do that in every case either, and the plaintiff has not established that it does. But there is a public interest in that type of disclosure. But once the person has been acquitted or the case has been dismissed, then the balance definitely favors respect for the personal privacy of that individual. There are no further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Spitzer, you have time, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me try to say two things. And the first is that the word vindicated is not necessarily the right word to use about people who haven't been convicted. We all know there are some innocent people who are convicted, and there are some guilty people who are not convicted. There may be.
You really want us to say that?
I think we all know that, whether you say it or not.
I
but
know.
Just
it's just surprising to hear you say that.
It's a fact in the world. And
well,
doesn't
that actually hurt your case? Because, I mean, people learning that someone was indicted could, because of the burden of proof, nevertheless say, well, yeah, I know he was they dropped the charges or he was acquitted, but, you know, that's because the jury didn't find he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's right, Your
Honor. He's probably guilty.
There's a public interest.
But that's the private. That's why the privacy interest, it seems to me, is so much higher on that side.
Well, it doesn't lead me to that conclusion, Your Honor. It seems to me there's a public interest. Once a person has gone beyond the stage of a non-public police investigation or grand jury investigation to a public indictment, often with a press release or a news conference, there's a public interest in seeing how that process plays out. The trial is public.
You don't want us to really say they're probably guilty anyway.
No. Of course not, and
well,
I hope they weren't.
Yeah.
But
so therefore their privacy interest isn't much different from the convicted person.
We can't really, our view is that their privacy interest is not much different for the factual reason that it's no longer private. Whatever may have been the case 25 years ago, it's just no longer private.
If I could just follow on that, it seems to me ultimately what you're saying, even though you're labeling it different, is that there really isn't a difference in the privacy interest for someone convicted and someone who's been indicted. It's just that we recognize or that we don't recognize the legitimacy of the privacy interest for the convicted person because they've been convicted in some sense.
And this court recognized that the convicted people did still have some privacy interest.
Is that
not
true? Is your answer to his question yes? You don't really, because when you read your brief, I had the same impression Judge Kavanaugh did.
Well,
your view is there really isn't much of a difference.
Yes, that is our view.
Yeah.
We conceded in the earlier appeal that there was some marginal difference, and I don't want to walk away from that. But as a practical matter, I don't think it's nearly enough to be dispositive here. There's a public interest in seeing how the judicial system works, and that may include looking at cases of guilty verdicts to see if those verdicts were correct. And it may also include looking at some acquittals or dismissals to see if those were proper dispositions of cases. There's a public interest in both directions that can be served in appropriate cases by FOIA, request. And this case is not seeking to pursue that particular public interest, was the person rightly convicted or rightly acquitted, but to find out what the government had done as part of that prosecution on an issue of tremendous public interest, namely the use of cell phone tracking without getting a finding of probable cause and a judicial authorization.
If you got the information, would you try to contact the individuals?
What we did with the 214 was contacted the lawyers only. Of course, someone else could make the same request and could try to contact the individuals. We couldn't stop that. The court has to be aware of that. But if someone wanted to find out, you know, who on their block had been federally indicted for the purpose of harassing them, telling their children not to play with their children, they wouldn't need to make a FOIA request for people whose cases involved cell phone tracking. They would just type in their name and address into Google and Pacer. So there's no privacy being protected by the government's position in this case.
But I think, as I understand the government's point is that it is that while people would not be affirmatively looking for information on these six people unless these files are released. That's their point. In other words, true, you could look it up, but no one's going to. But now the FOIA request will release the information that no one else would have searched for or might not have searched for. That's their point, isn't it?
Well, I think if we're talking about practicalities, which I think you are, Your Honor, the practicality here is the only people who are going to look up these cases are the ACLU,
right,
and we're going to contact their lawyers. And the lawyers we contacted in the past either ignored us or were glad to have heard from us.
You can't do it unless you get the information.
That's right. We could contact these same six people, except we'd have to contact an enormously greater universe of federal indictees. So this narrows it down, but it doesn't narrow it down in any way that has to do with the nature of the crime they were indicted for. Was it a horrible crime? Was it a petty crime? It has nothing to do with whether there was newspaper articles about a public trial or not. It only has to do with whether there was cell phone tracking. And that particular fact is not a fact that would be embarrassing to a defendant.
The fact that there was cell phone tracking.
The government says,
what's embarrassing to these people who might have returned to their normal lives is that they once indicted for a crime.
That's right, and that fact is simply not private. That is the embarrassing part.
Let me ask you a different question.
Yeah.
Suppose the 214 files that you obtained in the first part of this case had instead been, say, released by a newspaper that had done some serious investigative reporting, and it had released all that information. But the only thing it couldn't get its hands on were these six files of acquitted people. Would the public interest analysis be focused just on those six files in the FOIA case?
Well, I'm not sure if I understand the question. Ordinarily...
Well, the question is, if the 214 files are now public, they couldn't get access to the six. You file a FOIA request for the six.
I see.
So do we look at just those six? Right, we do.
Under FOIA, I think because there's no way to know in advance unless the court looks in camera, there's no way to know in advance whether any particular document will be important or not. Every document is entitled to the same weight of public interest disclosure once there's a finding of a general public interest
request.
No, my point
is, wouldn't the court say, well, look, because of what the New York Times revealed, you already know everything you need to know about the relationship between cell phone tracking and prosecution, and these six won't tell you very much more, and all of these are people who are either acquitted or whose against charges were dismissed. Would your response be, well, no, you just don't look at the six, you look at the whole universe?
I think if you could say confidently that there is no further value to be served, and there were some cases cited in the briefs, I think, by both sides, where courts found that it was clear from the record that there was zero public interest remaining in some request, that that was a ground for denying. But we can't say that, and in some of those cases, there had been in-camera examination of documents. I don't think we can say that here, that there is zero value, any more than we could have said it about any six of the 214. It turned out that a couple of them involved suppression motions, but there was no way to know in advance without in-camera examination which those might have been.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Spitzer. The case is submitted. Thank you both.